Right, shall we make a start? Good evening and welcome to this evening's talk at the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Netanya Rolofsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I start tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program talk will be a discussion on how vaping can save 1 million years of life on Wednesday, 6 February. Further details and online registration should hopefully be available imminently on the SIAS website. The SIAS pub quiz will take place on the 31st of Jan, and further details can also be found on the SIAS website. And a few standard notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS, so we do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFA fellows and £12 for students. Further details are also provided on our website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign this on your way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not automatically get added to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after the talk. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We'll email you a short online survey after the talk, so please do take a minute to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. And then if the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. And then finally, a reminder to switch all your mobile phones to silent. So back to tonight's talk. It'll last around an hour and then be followed by Q&A with the speakers. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. Now, SIAS did start off as a place where students can come and share research and that kind of thing. So I do ask you all to play nicely and play nice with the other kids and ask nice questions throughout the night. For any challenging discussions, there's always the speakers that you can go talk to afterwards. And then we do value everyone's opinion, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and also one from any fellow. So please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your question. And then following the meeting, there will be snacks and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so please do join us. So our speakers, Mary-Lise Tassoni and Kyle Audley, are consulting actuaries in the London office of the global actuarial consultancy Milliman. Mary-Lise has a wide range of experience in the UK retirement market, having produced a range of research papers looking at the performance of retirement products in the UK, as well as customer needs and challenges. She has experience of retirement-related product development, in particular, looking at the feasibility of bringing overseas retirement products to the market in the UK. Mary-Lise is also a member of the IFOA Working Party, modelling innovative pre- and post-retirement products. Kyle has recent experience in the UK retirement market, having developed a model exploring the performance of retirement products in the UK and comparing the benefits of various investment strategies. He has spoken on developments in the UK insurance market as a result of Brexit at industry events and is a member of the IFOA Working Party on the impact of climate change on life actuaries. On that note, I'll hand over to Mary-Lise.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mary-Lise Tassoni, and I'd like to welcome you to this talk on Annuities Reinvented. Over the course of this session, my colleague Kyle and I will be sharing with you some of the highlights of Milliman's latest research into retirement, which looks at whether replacing bonds with annuities as part of a retirement strategy can increase income sustainability without compromising on death benefits. Now, we have brought some of the copies of the white paper that we published last year with us, so if you are interested to read more, please pick one up after the talk. And I just need to say before we get started that any views or opinions expressed by Kyle or myself this evening are our own and not necessarily representative of Milliman. So Milliman's interest and expertise in retirement stems from many different sources. Firstly, being actuaries, it's not a huge surprise that longevity is somewhat of a specialist subject. And this is clearly a key consideration when making retirement decisions. Another key to the retirement problem is investment and investment risk, managing that in terms of investment strategies. And Milliman's financial risk management teams discuss with insurers the best way of hedging retirement guarantees and managing those, and also operate in risk-managed funds. And Milliman globally works on developing stochastic retirement tools which can help individuals to assess and quantitatively consider their retirement options, both in the accumulation and decumulation phases. But lastly, and probably more relevantly to today's talk, is the work that we do looking at retirement products, considering products that are used overseas and how well they would fit in with the UK market from both consumer requirement perspective and product providers' capital requirements. And also that the research that we do, that not only considers products, but also consumers and their requirements and needs. Now, the research that we're presenting this evening is a direct reaction to the changes that we've seen in the retirement market. In March 2014, the government announced their plans for pensions freedom, with George Osborne declaring that no one would ever have to buy an annuity again. And this sparked some fears that pensioners might end up spending all their retirement savings in one go. So far, this seems to be relatively unfounded. The FCA's recent retirement outcomes review shows that they've seen no evidence of unsustainable spending. And while it is true that over half of people have withdrawn their pension pots fully since pensions freedom was introduced, there's evidence that shows that most of these pots were relatively small, and the vast majority of the people had other sources of retirement income. And that's generally the case with current retirees, is that they're not necessarily representative of what's to come, because many will have sources of defined benefit income, and so their defined contribution pot is unlikely to be solely their source of retirement income. But while the media was kind of captivated by the idea of pensioners blowing all their savings on luxury cars, it seems a fairly unlikely course of action for someone that spent 40 years saving for retirement. And perhaps a more realistic fear is that someone would simply outlive their pension pot by spending too much each year, investment returns being poor, or simply living longer than they'd planned to. And that's why, in the advent of pensions freedom, there was a lot of discussion about how hybrid retirement products, or third-way retirement products, could be of benefit. So these are products that aim to kind of bridge the gap between an annuity and a drawdown. So still offering some level of guaranteed income for life, but still providing the flexibility that annuities didn't afford. And so, to coincide with the implementation of pensions freedom, many insurers released these hybrid retirement products. In 2016, Milliman was asked to conduct a market review of the current products on offer, and we looked at annuities, inflation-linked annuities, variable annuities, fixed annuities, drawdowns with guarantees, and drawdowns, so covering a whole range of products that were on offer. And we assessed these products from the value for money perspective, the way that they were meeting customer requirements, simplicity, and flexibility. What's interesting is, although that research was only published about 2 years ago, most of the products that I mentioned that we covered in the talk are no longer available. And so now, almost 4 years on from when pensions freedom was first implemented, most customers really only have two product choices when it comes to retirement, and that's an annuity and drawdown. And they're fairly far apart, and not one necessarily would cover all of the requirements of an average consumer. And that's why we wanted to research how potentially those two products could be combined together to produce something more effective. So the obvious benefit of a drawdown is the flexibility that it provides to customers. It allows customers to take as much money as they want, whenever they want to, fund size permitting, and they can control the investment strategy. And although they can offer the potential for high returns, most customers will be relying on their drawdown for some level of retirement income throughout their lives. And so it's unlikely that they're going to take a high-risk, high-reward strategy, such as fully investing in equities. And that's why most customers choose to invest a portion of their fund in something that's lower risk, but increases income sustainability, but that will also dampen returns, such as bonds. Now, bonds do obviously reduce market risk, but they don't completely eliminate it. And they also don't do anything about other key retirement risks, such as longevity. Annuities, on the other hand, can eliminate both longevity and investment risk from the consumer's perspective by passing it on to the insurer. And that can lead customers to be able to take more risks with the other part of their fund. In addition, annuities can actually offer higher returns than bonds because an insurer, as an institutional investor, has much more of an ability to invest in a wider range of assets. In addition, the claims, because they're managing a large book of business, their claims volatility will be less, and so they can invest in things like illiquid assets, which will provide a higher return. And lastly, because most annuities don't actually offer a significant death benefit, they tend to have a higher income than bonds, whereas bonds obviously have to return funds on death. And so it seemed to us that if someone is looking to put a portion of their retirement fund into something that is lower risk and increases income sustainability, then maybe annuities would be better suited than bonds. And that's really what this research set out to find out. We designed two strategies which we compared against retirement to see which was the most effective in a variety of different circumstances. The first strategy is the equity bond, the bond equity strategy, which is where a consumer will use their retirement fund in a drawdown that invests in a portfolio of equities and bonds, and also a cash account for flexibility. The second strategy is the annuity equity strategy, where the consumer still invests in a drawdown, but investing only in equities, and the portion that they would have initially invested in bonds is used to purchase an underwritten level annuity. And then they also have a cash account. So the equity and bond portfolios that we use to model this strategy are been benchmarked to typical drawdown strategies, but they're not necessarily designed to replicate any particular one. We used a mixture of the equity portfolio, we used a mixture of UK equities, global equities, and a small allocation to property. And for the bond portfolios, it's a mixture of UK corporate and government bonds. The annuity that we used was based on real market quotes. It's an underwritten level annuity and includes a five-year guaranteed payment period. So if the consumer would die within the first 5 years, their beneficiaries would receive the remaining payments outstanding for that five-year period. So we modeled these two strategies across the course of retirement over 1,000 different economic scenarios. But as well as considering different investment circumstances, we also wanted to consider different consumers, as no one is the same and everyone reaches retirement at different points and circumstances. So we considered consumers of a multiple different ages and also different health statuses. We also considered consumers wanting different levels of income in retirement and whether they would want a fixed level of income across retirement or to increase with inflation. And then we also considered risk preferences, how much equity someone would be prepared to invest in, and how much cash. And so combining all these factors together, we ended up with millions of results. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through them all today, so we'll be focusing the results presented around a core example customer. So this is Robin. She's a 65-year-old who reaches retirement in good health with a pension pot of £100,000. She wants to have an income throughout her retirement that increases with inflation, but she is interested in leaving something behind for her children. So we assume an initial target income of £4,000 a year, increasing with inflation. And in terms of an underlying investment strategy, under both strategies, 5% of her fund will be invested in cash, 55% in equities, and the remaining 40% will either be in bonds or annuity. And then to compare these two products, for each year of retirement, we modelled the likelihood of Robin achieving her target income, the average shortfall, so the difference between meeting her target income and what she actually receives, and the average death benefit, which is calculated as the components of the drawdown and cash account funds and any income that's due from the guaranteed payment period for the annuity strategy. So this graph shows the likelihood of Robin meeting her target income. The electric blue line are the results for the annuity equity strategy, and the green dotted line are the results for the bond equity strategy. And in pale blue vertical lines, we've also got the likelihood of survival, so Robin reaching certain points of retirement. For example, there's a 75% chance of her reaching to 22 years of retirement. So what I think is helpful to do when looking at this graph is to look at it in sections. The first section is probably not the most interesting graph you've ever seen, but it is good news for Robin. What it shows is that for that period of time, for a retirement of that length, she is pretty much guaranteed to meet her target level of income under both strategies. And so what that means is if Robin was only planning a retirement of 13 years, there's not a lot to choose from between these two strategies using this metric. And so she'd be best to look at something else, like death benefit. In the next section of the graph, you can see that the likelihood of meeting target income has reduced in both strategies, with the bond equity strategy doing slightly better. The reasoning behind this is that for the annuity equity strategy, Robin has had to use a portion of her fund, 40%, to initially purchase the annuity. So her fund size could be smaller and therefore less resilient to a series of very negative investment returns. But what is worth remembering is that in the case where Robin is unable to meet her target income using this strategy, she will still be receiving an income from the annuity. It just will be lower than her target income. Whereas under the bond equity strategy, she won't be receiving anything at all if she doesn't meet her target income, because it means that the drawdown fund and the cash account are completely depleted. And I think the last section of the graph is probably the most interesting, because if Robin was planning a retirement, this is sort of the section of the graph that's most relevant, as that's what she's statistically most likely to experience. And as you can see, the annuity equity strategy has the higher likelihood of providing Robin with her target income, and that gap between the two increases over time. Now, there are several reasons behind this. First, as I alluded to earlier, annuities can provide higher return in terms of income during somebody's life. And secondly, under our strategy, in the annuity equity strategy, we assume that the annuity is purchased at outset, and then there are no further annuity purchases. So what that means is over time, there's no rebalancing between the equity and annuity components. Whereas under the bond strategy, the bond equity strategy, when someone's investing in a bond equity fund, you would expect some level of rebalancing every year. And so over time, the equity component can grow in the annuity equity strategy without sort of other things being rebalanced and the returns being dampened. But overall, what I think this graph is useful to demonstrate is that if someone is planning a retirement where they want to use their pension fund to create an income over the course of their retirement, then the annuity equity strategy definitely seems favorable. Now, this graph shows a similar situation, but assuming that Robin wanted a fixed level income, so £4,000 a year that doesn't increase with inflation. And as you can see, it's not a huge surprise that both of the strategies perform better. There's a higher likelihood of Robin meeting her target income in both cases. And that's not surprising because it's a less onerous requirement of her pension fund. But what is interesting is that at no point does the bond equity strategy outperform the annuity equity strategy, and that there's well over a 90% likelihood of Robin achieving her target income each year with the annuity equity strategy. Now, the assumption that someone would want a fixed amount of income every year for each year of their retirement is perhaps a simplification, and as is the idea that someone would necessarily want their income to increase with inflation, as in both cases, there's an implicit assumption that someone's spending habits aren't going to change. With inflation protection, what that just effectively means is that someone's going to keep buying the same things, but that inflation, they were just wanting to protection against the cost of those things inflating. Whereas realistically, over such a period of time and changes in people's lives, they're likely to have different spending habits, and there's definitely evidence to show that that's the case. However, for this project, we've kind of kept that as a simplification. So we thought it would be interesting to see how the results would change if Robin wanted a much higher target level of income. So in this graph, it's £8,000 a year as opposed to £4,000 a year that I showed earlier. And what's interesting is that it is very different to the first graph that I showed in terms of shape. As you can see, the annuity equity strategy at no point outperforms the bond equity strategy. And that kind of goes to show that the annuity equity strategy isn't really designed for someone that's trying to take out a large portion of their fund over a short period of time. And we chose the £8,000 as an example because that equates to an 8% withdrawal rate. And according to FCA research, that's the most common withdrawal rate that policyholders with pensions pots under £250,000 are using. And what's really worrying about that piece of information is that even though the bond equity strategy does do better, it's still highly unlikely that anyone would be able to withdraw that amount of money consistently over their retirement. And whilst, as I did say, it could be that that's just reflective of people that aren't necessarily using their defined contribution pots as their major source of income due to having other things such as defined benefit income, it still shows the importance of setting an appropriate level of withdrawal rate. And then for comparison, we also show the results with a decreasing target income, so this is £3,000 a year. And in this case, quite to the reverse of the opposite of the other graph, there is no point at which the bond equity strategy outperforms the annuity equity strategy, which has over a 90% likelihood of meeting Robin's target requirements over the period shown in the graph. And I think what this graph and the last graph really demonstrate is the fact that this is a strategy which is not necessary for everyone. It is far more designed for someone that is looking to use their pension pot as something to generate them an income that will last the entirety of their retirement, rather than something where they want to access the money over a short period of time. Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, we want to look at a variety of different consumer circumstances and preferences. And one of the important ones to consider is health. Not everyone is likely to be as lucky as Robin to arrive at retirement in good health. And so we wanted to consider how the results would change depending on different health statuses. So we considered four in total: healthy, which is what Robin was categorized as, and that's defined as someone that is feeling well and is on no sort of medication. Then there's reasonable, which is someone who's feeling okay, but they might be on medication for something like high cholesterol. Then there's challenging, which is someone who's struggling a bit, but they might have some kind of long-term health condition. And lastly, it's critical, who is someone who's being treated for something, some serious health condition such as cancer. Now, as per the other graphs, the green dotted line shows the results of the bond equity strategy. And as you can see, there's no variation in those results based on health status. But for the annuity equity strategy, the results do vary because the annuity was underwritten. And it's probably no surprise that the most severe the health status, sort of the more income that the annuity is generating, and so the better it looks like it performs on our graph. For example, sort of dark red line is for someone who has a critical health annuity. And that plus the challenging one, at no point does the bond equity strategy outperform it. However, I don't think this graph necessarily shows the whole story, because obviously someone that has qualified for a critical health annuity isn't necessarily going to have the same view on the planning period for retirement as someone who qualifies as a healthy annuity. And so what's important to do is to view these results in the context of the person's life expectancy. So in this table, we've got the point at which the annuity equity strategy outperforms the bond equity strategy compared against the customer's life expectancy for someone that would fall into that health category. As we've seen before, with the healthy status, the annuity equity strategy outperforms the bond strategy well in advance of life expectancy. But there's quite a different story for the critical health status. As you can see, the critical health annuity equity strategy outperforms the bond equity strategy at age 81, but the life expectancy is much shorter, as being 70. Now, that's not necessarily to say that someone with that condition would necessarily not want to choose the annuity equity strategy. If we go back to the previous graph, although the annuity equity strategy for someone of critical health doesn't outperform the bond equity until age 81, it has a performance that equally matches it up until that point. And so there's nothing really to choose between these strategies up until that point. And so what that really means to say is that if somebody is in that condition and is trying to choose between these strategies, the point at which they're most likely to be alive, the two strategies are performing equally well when we consider this likelihood metric. And so it would be better to use a different metric, such as death benefit, to consider which product would be best. And with that, I will hand over to Kyle to talk about our other two metrics.
Thank you, Marilise. Good evening, everyone. My name's Kyle Audley, and in the second half of this talk, I'll be covering two of the other metrics we use to compare strategies, the income shortfall and the death benefit, and then we'll move on to look at some of the potential areas for future research, building on what we've done so far. So to our first metric, or a second metric, and that's average shortfall in retirement given for each future year. We define our average shortfall as our target income for a given year less the income received. And if in a year we're able to meet that threshold, meet that target or exceed it, that's considered a zero shortfall. So this is therefore purely a measure of downside, saying if we've been unable to meet a target, by what proportion have we fallen short of our income? So returning to our retiree Robin and looking at the potential income shortfalls over the 35 years of her retirement from age 65 to 100, we can look at how our two strategies compare. Again, with our bond equity strategy shown in green and our annuity equity strategy shown in blue. And similar to our likelihood of meeting income, it's possibly easier to look at this in three real sections or three stages. And we can see from year zero to around 14, both strategies are quite similar. We're expecting to see zero shortfall and that both strategies can meet our income requirements. We've then a brief period from around year 15 to around year 22 where we start to see a small expected shortfall and perhaps the annuity equity strategy leading to a slightly larger shortfall in income. And then around year 23, 24, quite a sharp increase in the relative shortfall on the bond equity strategy relative to the annuity equity strategy. And then at very, very late ages, you can see that we're expecting a much larger shortfall in income from our bond equity relative to our annuity equity. I think what's also important to take away from this chart that perhaps isn't immediately present is, as Marilise raised, in a bond equity strategy, when you're 100% in drawdown, for a given year, you can either meet that income requirement or you can't. You can either 100% income target or 0%. So to take a point like year 26, where we have a 20% average shortfall, what we're really saying is that in that 26th year of retirement, you can meet your income 100% in 80% of cases, but in that other 20%, you're actually not able to draw down anything from your fund. And this is perhaps another advantage of equity, of annuity and equity, that will still receive some proportion, and it isn't quite such a stark binary option as it is with the bond and equity strategy. So to our next metric, and death benefit for future years, this is just defined simply as the value of any assets held at death. So the value of the drawdown and the value of any guarantee period that might be inherent in your annuity. So immediately, again, we show annuity equity in blue and bond equity in green. And I think probably from the starting point, you see quite a stark contrast in the two strategies. By keeping in a bond equity strategy, 100%, £100,000 stays in that fund on day one. And if you're unfortunate enough to die that soon into retirement, that's all fully realizable as a death benefit. Compared to our annuity equity strategy in blue, where we see that by annuitizing 40% of that fund, our actual starting position for death benefits is considerably lower. But as we move through retirement, we see these two death benefits begin to converge reasonably quickly, and that's because any income required is coming out of that bond equity fund, and therefore the death benefit available from it is deteriorating far more quickly. Whereas in our annuity equity fund, we're only needing to draw down from that fund just to make up the difference between our annuity income and our income target for the year. What you see then is around sort of year 22, those death benefits cross and beyond that point, it's actually possible to achieve a higher death benefit using an annuity equity strategy over a bond equity one. And that advantage just increases and increases into the later stages of retirement. And if we overlay on this our survival probabilities, which I appreciate aren't too clear on the projector, we can see that actually the point at which these two strategies cross, there's still a 75% chance of being alive. And at our best estimate of life expectancy, our annuity equity strategies opened up a sort of a £15,000 advantage, and that just continues to increase over time. We know that it isn't just the average death benefit that we need to consider, and really for our 1,000 scenarios, it's the range of results that we can take around that average that's quite important. So what we've shown here in our green bands are some of the ranges that our death benefit can take. So for this chart, we've excluded the top 10% of scenarios and the bottom 10% of scenarios because those results are correspondingly extreme. So what we have in the end is, in the lightest green band, we've our 90th percentile to our 75th percentile. Beneath that, the 75th to the 50th, then the 50th to the 25th. And finally, in the darkest green, we've our worst performing scenarios from the 25th percentile right down to the 10th. And overlaid on this, again for our bond equity strategy, is the same average curve that we showed on the previous chart. I think, percentiles aside, the most important way I understand this graph is that we have a 50% chance of occupying one of these two middle columns, a 25% chance of exceeding that and getting a better benefit, and a 25% chance of being down here and suffering the worst benefit. So with those two charts introduced, or with that chart introduced, we can again compare our two strategies on the same basis. And by exploring some of the key boundary points, some of the key areas of these distributions, we can start to bring out some more detailed results of our death benefit. Again, with bond equity in green and annuity equity in blue. So perhaps first of all, the most striking, we see that in the best performing scenarios, there's the potential for a significantly higher death benefit by using our annuity equity strategy. Then as we come down through the quartiles, we see that at the 75th, our annuity equity is able to, over 35 years, preserve the value of that fund, as opposed to our bond equity fund, which has diminished to around 40% of its original value, which is, at this point, at age 100, about £20,000 less. If we take our median, highlighted in yellow, we can see that at the very end of our projection, we've still a non-zero expected value for our fund in the annuity equity, meaning that even at 35 years into retirement, we've got a greater than 50% chance that there's going to be something left in our drawdown fund, whereas the bond equity fund is hitting that 50% chance of being exhausted at around year 33 or age 98. And then finally, in our very, very worst performing scenarios, we can see that even when investment conditions are very poor, the annuity equity fund is able to preserve some value in that fund for about a year or two longer. So overall, bringing these results together, we can say that it might be possible under an annuity equity strategy to take on more upside without any increase in the downside and arguably a slight reduction. So to the conclusions of our research so far, I think our main conclusion is that an annuity does present some benefits as a component of a drawdown fund relative to bonds, and that's both in income certainty in retirement and for the potential for a higher death benefit, which may be something not previously associated with the word annuity. Secondly, we can say that first result isn't universal, that there are key features of our retiree that are going to influence how much they're able to access that benefits, and that's primarily their target withdrawal rate and their level of health as they enter retirement. And then finally, that annuities perhaps shouldn't be discounted from discussions around retirement, and that past concerns around flexibility or the lack of death benefit should, you know, be tackled and challenged, and they may be a good option. If you want to read any further into the research we've done so far, there is a link to our white paper, as well as 30 or so copies somewhere in the building. Also, please feel free to grab myself or Mary-Lise. We'd be happy to send on a copy or to discuss further. So, moving on from our research, and where do we go next, and what do we think are the sort of key areas for future development? We've highlighted these four as some sort of key topics, key areas that we think will add some clarity or another piece in the problem of a retirement solution. And in this section, we'll look into them each a bit further, but at a high level, we've got the option for further annuity purchases in retirement rather than just a single immediate purchase at the point of retirement. Taking a wider view of a person's wealth, not just looking at a single savings pot, but bringing other assets into the discussion. Then trying to capture more complex customer behavior, not expecting someone to set an amount at retirement and purely inflate it. And then finally, I guess separately from how you choose to explore the modeling and those sort of complications, just can we condense this down into some sort of consumer-friendly metric that someone can actually use at retirement rather than being handed a model or a series of charts? So to our first area of exploration and further annuity purchases. And although there could arguably any number of annuity strategies for retirement, I think these could be broadly summarized in two main groups. And that's staged immediate annuity purchases as you progress through retirement, or the purchase of a deferred annuity at the point that you retire. And really all of this is based on the trend shown in this chart here, that we know that annuity rates increase with age, and that by some combination of these strategies, is it possible to access these higher rates as you go through retirement and increase your level of income. So to our first strategy, and just further annuity purchases as you go through retirement. So we have the first option, which is an age-based sort of schedule for annuitization. And this could be a simple rule of thumb that says something along the lines of every N years of retirement, annuitize X percent of your fund. And this presents quite a simple strategy for people. You will, depending on how often you do it, you will step up and achieve a higher annuity rate. And it avoids any sort of concerns around trying to time anything, and it avoids complex decision making. There's then the option for further annuity purchases based on your fund and on fund performance. It may be familiar that there be some sort of degree of annuitization as your fund depletes over time, but we could explore the options around annuitization after periods of very good investment growth, where you could look to lock in that capital growth and turn that into an income, or even develop a potential glide path as your drawdown fund diminishes and you stage an annuity purchase as that goes down. Both of these, given that you have to purchase this annuity at a point in future, have an inherent amount of interest rate risk that it is unclear what annuity rates will be prevailing at that point in future, and that is one risk that you would bear. All you know at a given point in future is that you're likely to get a better rate than someone younger than you, but not that the entire curve itself may have moved in your favor. And then we've our second group of strategies, our deferred annuity strategy, which would involve taking a proportion of our retirement fund and purchasing that deferred annuity to start at a later date or a later age, but purchased at the point of retirement. The advantage here being that you don't bear interest rate risk in the same way as the future annuity purchases, because you're able to access and crystallize those annuity rates associated with higher age at the point of retirement. There are some negatives with a deferred annuity strategy. At the moment, it's largely hypothetical because deferred annuities aren't readily available in the UK market, and their capital-intensive nature doesn't make them the most attractive product class for future offerings. There's also a concern around how do you communicate the advantage of such a strategy to someone, convincing them that at the point of retirement, they need to take a considerable chunk of their fund and invest it in an asset from which they may never draw down an income, but that they may only ever get that premium back if they were to die during their deferment period. But arguably, if you can overcome these strategy, these issues or these problems, it's possible to try and access these higher annuity rates earlier or throughout retirement. Then move on, and we've the option to look at other sources of income and other sorts of wealth in retirement. And we know that most people, when they get to retirement, aren't just bringing a single pot of X pounds with them, but people have other sources of wealth and some other sources of income. And some of the key ones we've brought out here, so I think maybe more prominent for more imminent retirees or recent retirees is the benefits associated with defined benefit pension schemes. People who spent large proportions of their career accruing benefits in this can reach retirement with quite a material level of income from this. There's the value held in property and accessing that through equity release. A significant amount of value can be held in property, and for those with limited private provision, it's possible that quite a significant proportion of their wealth is held in property. And so with the availability to access a proportion of the value held in that property using equity release, it could change their income during retirement. We've then supplementary income, and this really comes from the idea that retirement isn't quite as final as perhaps it may have been once, and that people are often moving into semi-retirement, working part-time or working periodically. And this additional source of income recognizes that at a time when people may be typically in the past decumulating their funds, there may still be income coming in externally. It may be possible to save during a time where you also have access to your pension funds. And finally, there's a sort of private pension provision where we just capture anything held in savings destined for retirement. So though this may be perhaps the most similar to the pot we've considered so far, there may be sort of, arguably complications around tax or access to this. But it's in taking a view of all of these components together that we really understand what resources people have available at retirement, and also to consider the different characteristics of these, whether they're lump sums, how certain, how frequent they are, can only build up that picture of what people will have available to them at the point of retirement or during their retirement. We've then, perhaps most difficult of all, predicted human behavior or considering the more complex customer behavior throughout retirement. And there are a lot of factors here. So we brought out some of the key ones, and I guess fundamentally there's some clear spending patterns during retirement. As you first retire and you're in good health and you've still 100% of your pot, it's likely that there'd be greater discretionary spending as people take holidays, make purchases, and we might see in the early stages a higher level of withdrawal. As that activity diminishes over time and with age, we might see actually that spending falling to more essentials, less discretionary spending, and capturing that asymmetry in spending during retirement, I think, is an important point. With then the idea of performance-based spending and fund performance-based spending, which says if you are fortunate enough to enjoy many years of good investment return, it's likely that you're going to tap into that. And if you wanted £5,000 a year and you've been lucky to double your pot, it's likely you're going to bring up your quality of living to match. And conversely, if you're very close to exhausting your fund, or if you're suffering very bad returns, that you might cut back, tighten the belt, and try and preserve that fund for as long as possible. And then finally, two other main drivers to capture is the potential for long-term care and the needs and costs associated with that. And also just the sense of unknown or uncertainty in retirement, both in spending habits, uncertain events. Ultimately, we're capturing a sort of potentially 20 to 30 year period. It's likely something uncertain will happen. And do you have the liquidity and the flexibility if such a thing were to happen? And then finally, it's our metrics and how we condense all of this down for someone who needs to make a decision at retirement. We can't just give them a wealth of of numbers and graphs and charts. We need to communicate this in some way that's both simple to understand but valuable. So elsewhere, you know, consumers may be familiar with the concept of a credit score. And if we could work to something that's a 0 to 999 measure of how creditworthy you are and how likely someone is to lend to you in the near future. But this really only captures one metric, how likely someone is to lend to you at a single point in time now. So it's very difficult to come up with an equivalent when you're trying to juggle multiple criteria and you're trying to measure those criteria periodically throughout a retirement. So we can break this out into this more school report style system here, where we can bring our individual criteria, some of the metrics we've used tonight, death benefit, average shortfall, or just the certainty of meeting your income, and we can grade these individually. And perhaps this gives consumers the option to place their own weighting in these different metrics and decide what's important to them. But again, you have the issue of how you condense 30 years of meeting income into a single score. So to conclude, I think our research to date has shown some of the immediate benefits that you could receive by exploring annuities as a component of a drawdown fund. We've also looked at, you know, how we think we can build on that research, build a fuller picture of retirement and a more complete solution to what someone does when they face retirement. So thank you all for your time. Marylise and I would be happy to take any questions and happy to hear any thoughts.
Right, any questions from the audience? Remember to state your name and your qualification status, if that's okay. Yes, can someone bring the microphone? Thanks, John.
Thank you, Marylise and Carl. So my name's Phil Simpson and I'm a fellow. Two-part question. One was, you very much focused on Robin, who obviously had one set of characteristics. Were there other customer profiles that you looked at that would give a different appropriateness of one strategy against another? Was that something you looked into? And the second part is really around the extensions you discussed, particularly around consumer behavior. I guess the approach you've taken is very much people have equal preferences for losing or gaining money. But if you look at some of the behavioral economic research, particularly things like Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize last year, seems to be some evidence that people value gains maybe twice as much as losses, or they fear losses twice as much as gains. So people in their decision making, particularly in their buying preferences, wouldn't put equal weights on whether it was above or below their target. So there's probably some elements of behavioural economics you could bring in to the extensions of the research that might perhaps make it might give you some insights that following more normal classical economics wouldn't.
First part. The results we presented today definitely focused around sort of one customer because, as I said, we did model it for, I can't remember the exact number, but thousands of different customers. And the paper really kind of just explores around Robin as a core customer, but we also look at how that varies. A little how I touched in earlier, with the likelihood of income, of what happens if you have a different health status, or what happens if you turn inflation protection off, or what happens if you vary the withdrawal rate. And in the paper itself, it goes into a couple more of the different variations around that, and also for the other metrics such as death benefits as well. So it is definitely something we explored, and all of our results are actually available on the Just website. There's a tool where you can put in any number of combinations and sort of see the results from there. But I think rather than just boring people with graph after graph after graph, we decided to necessarily try and keep some level of narrative to today's presentation.
Yeah. I think on the second part, that is certainly a part of if we explore more complex behavior. I think that's one part of it. I think there may be some lower hanging fruit in terms of how we can build more complex behavior in. That's just more, I guess we could just say evidence-based, things like how people en masse spend during retirement, so to take that early higher spending and later lower spending. So it will be something to build into more complex behaviour, but maybe not one of the first things to build in.
But you are definitely right about the issue about loss aversion as a sort of behavioural economics issue. I think it's that people would rather avoid a gain twice as much, rather avoid a loss twice as much as they'd like a gain. And people get actually more risk averse in retirement. So although people are naturally risk averse, I think something like it can over double people's aversion to risk when they get to retirement. And so that's obviously something that needs to be counterbalanced in product design to assure people that necessarily that's not an appropriate way to think about the situation, even though that's someone's gut instinct.
Good question. We had a question from over there somewhere.
Thanks for the presentation. I've not read the white paper yet, but I'm keen to now. It looks like you've got a very wide range of areas to look into for further research. One thing that seems intuitive to me, though, that seemed like you were talking about low-hanging fruit, and another advantage of annuities is that you talked about the dynamic whereby if your investment returns perform well, you will spend more, and if they perform badly, maybe you'll try and cut back. But in terms of the longevity risk, the same dynamic doesn't apply. So if you're 90 years old and you've got a pot of £30,000, you could live 2 years, say you draw down £15,000 a year, or you could live 6 years. So that kind of, how do you address that decision once you're in that position? That's a very difficult dynamic to address. And so I think there's an additional benefit there. If you've got an annuity, then that gives you a baseline so that in terms of the longevity risk component of your overall risk, that is reduced. So that the practicality there of if you do get into that position, how do you manage that very difficult investment decision about how much to draw down becomes simpler if part of it is annuitized. And if there was a market in deferred annuities, I think that would be a great way to address that problem of that kind of longevity tail risk.
Yeah, I agree that I think that's an advantage of annuity of not having to necessarily make more decisions, especially kind of at later ages. In your example, someone who's 90, it is unlikely that someone's going to be necessarily wanting to spend a huge amount of time also trying to think about these kind of problems. And that's something in other research that we've explored is the idea of someone sort of incrementally buying annuities because the chances are that the flexibility that's a benefit of a drawdown is less appealing in that age, and that kind of certainty and not having to necessarily consider those options is more of an advantage as you get older.
Yeah, I have to agree, particularly as it being very difficult to buy an annuity at age 90. It's best to, annuitize in a staged fashion rather than facing those decisions when actually some of the options that were available to you may have diminished by the time you get to that point. And as you said, talking about longevity risk, you may not be able to transfer it at age 90 as quickly and as readily as you could earlier in your retirement.
Excellent. And we've got a question from in the front here, on your right, Samir.
Sorry?
Yeah, on your right over there. Front.
Hello, Sean McCarthy is my name. I'm a student. I had a question about just on the deferred annuity market, well, the lack of it, but I mean, you guys probably know quite a bit about it. Do you know where it's at? Is it something that could come to the fore? Because people who are 65 are quite healthy nowadays.
I would say it's certainly something that, having presented this previously, that people are very eager to talk about. But very aware of the issues, particularly around just how very capital intensive it is. So if annuities are capital intensive, this is even more again. So I would say perhaps not so much as a state of the market, but I'd say we found that people are quite keen to talk about it as a potential solution, whether that's the makings or people, maybe proposing this internally. I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely something that when we've given this talk elsewhere, people have talked about. And also NEST, the Master Trust, government pensions, they kind of use the idea of a deferred annuity as a real sort of centrepiece of their sort of default retirement income strategy. And there are, I think, other master trusts that have also looked into the same thing, with the idea of it being like a potentially really useful tool as part of retirement income. But I think, as Kyle said, the capital requirements are unlikely that an insurer is necessarily going to want to offer it.
Do you know if they're available in any market around the world?
I don't think that there's particularly an active market at the moment.
None that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
So if you just go to the lady over there, yes, and then after that we can go to the gentleman.
Thanks for the presentation. My name is Ri Chen. I'm a fellow of the Institute. So I've got a question regarding to how this whole presentation is very interesting and it's very consumer focused. But looking from a product strategy perspective, when pension freedom arrives, a lot of the insurers in this market, they prioritize income drawdown over annuity products. Or a lot of them offer both products, but very few of them offer a combined version, like a hybrid version. Or I haven't seen any hybrid version of the product has become a mainstream product in this market. Why do you think that's the case if there's so many benefits for the consumers for this kind of hybrid strategy?
So I think, firstly, annuities definitely had a bad reputation. I think they were seen as pretty poor value for money, and especially because of the lack of a death benefit associated, although that is in some cases an option. And I don't think necessarily the way that pensions freedom was framed, sort of that quote from George Osborne saying that no one would ever have to buy them again, I think that's going to make people look into the benefits. So I think there's been like a movement away from annuities. They've sort of been rebranded as guaranteed income for life or GIFL and things like that. I think that people have kind of moved away from it as maybe a direct reaction to pensions freedom. As I mentioned earlier, sort of hybrid products that kind of were on the market, albeit not necessarily for a very long time, worked quite differently to the strategy that we're producing, which is you wouldn't necessarily need a provider to provide both of these. You could sort of buy them separately effectively, whereas the sort of guaranteed drawdown products, those hybrid ones, they were, I think, inherently maybe more complicated to understand because the amount of money that you took out from your drawdown affected the level of guarantee you had, and there were features like the month anniversary feature, where depending on the highest point that your fund had been over the last 12 months would set the new kind of guaranteed income. And while all of those are kind of clever features that were probably definitely beneficial, it's confusing for a consumer. And I think I read sort of key features documents that ran into 30 pages trying to explain all these features. And so I don't think that really helped them gain traction in the market. Whereas the strategy that we've mentioned here, I think, is hopefully kind of conceptually more easy for someone to understand, and they don't require an insurer to necessarily offer both combined because they can be purchased separately.
So are you thinking of, if we are pushing this strategy forward for these markets, more from advisor's point of view, where they provide retirement advice to the consumers, they consider these kind of options at the start, at the point of retirement?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
So if you're approaching this whole thing not from a product perspective, but from a consumer perspective, do you think it's due to the advisors when they are recommending retirement solutions to these consumers, they should consider these options?
Yeah, I guess. Based on sort of the results, I think that it's definitely a conversation worth having. And I don't think it's necessarily something that's just an onus on advisors. For example, that sort of FCA released as part of their remedies that they came to their retirement outcomes review, they suggested the idea of like default investment pathways as one of the remedies. And I think that something like that, the idea of when considering your options, if you're being asked to pick between a default option based on an investment strategy, something like this could be considered as one of those options rather than just only kind of considering drawdown and annuity separately. So I don't think it's something that's necessarily only something that an advisor should consider. It could be something that is offered, sort of advertised by product providers as an option as well.
Excellent, thanks. We've got another question from the back there.
My name is Mike Tyler. I used to be the finance director of Life Trust, which was set up in 2006 specifically to sell advanced life deferred annuities. So a couple of points just to pick up on some of the speakers. Firstly, the fact is that there is a vibrant market in the US selling advanced life deferred annuities for the very reasons that you've described in your paper. What we showed at the time, back in 2006, and what others have shown in various guises, is that advanced life deferred annuities are improve the efficiency of the retirement income over and above just a regular annuity. So if you go to, even before anyone had done this stochastically, the work that was done by Moshe Milevsky in his book, excellent book, The Calculus of Retirement Income, using relatively simplistic mortality and investment return models, and then using calculus to determine what was the most efficient outcomes, he demonstrated that the orders were better. If you look at Chen and Haberman's work in 2016 of why deferred annuities make sense, again, they demonstrate exactly the same thing. The challenge is not about the mathematics and the elegant financial mathematics. So we set that business up in 2006. We had to close it in 2008 because we couldn't get second round funding. So that was a practical problem with the markets, which we couldn't fix. But the challenge was twofold. Number one was the quality of advice from the intermediaries who were advising potential retirees was on average pretty poor. And so consequently, to describe some of the elegant solutions that you've put up, or we were trying to put up at that time, went over the heads of the advisors. And so they defaulted back to positions that were not good, not necessarily good for their clients. Secondly, the issue of you put up on your slide there of complex behavioural matters, the resistance by individuals to buying what is smart for them is just phenomenal. And the challenge we had, we did extensive market research at the time before we launched the product, and what we found was, to a person, they all thought the concept was really, really smart. The challenge was, when you actually asked them to sign a check 6 months or 12 months later when the product was up and running, they did not do that because of their loss aversion issue. And so until we can get over those positions, both the quality of the advice and to change those behavioural those decisions by the individuals, you know you're going to get locked into that problem. The capital issue which you've described is absolutely challenging for the insurer, but the problem lies elsewhere before you even get to that point.
Thank you, that's really interesting.
And then John, we've got someone over there.
Hi there, my name is Femi Bart-Williams, I'm a fellow. Thanks for a great presentation, really interesting. My question's perhaps slightly more boring. It's on the bond equity modelling that you've done. And I was curious how you've modelled the bond bit, because it strikes me as if you, there's certain strategies that, say, a typical insurer would use to generate income, so say a buy and maintain type strategies where you buy the corporate bonds, you know, based on generating a cash flow and you hold them as long as they're money good, basically. And that reduces the path dependency. Whereas if you presume that the investor is going to invest in a, you know, sort of old school index-based approach, that gives you all sorts of path dependency problems. And I wondered whether that might be part of the reason you're seeing annuities outperform credit or bonds in some of those strategies, because you've basically got a path dependency problem. But actually, if you're a pensioner or you're drawing down, you probably should invest in corporate bonds quite differently to an index-based approach. And I suspected you might be doing the index-based approach because you said something that I thought was interesting or perhaps telling. You said either you get the income from equity bonds or you get zero, which to me implies that you're doing a continuous rebalancing, as you said, between equities and bonds, but rebalancing between different bonds, which you probably shouldn't do if you're doing it from an income-based perspective, if that makes any sense.
I would say we have a financial risk management department who was closer to the specifics of modelling the bonds. So if you contact, his name's on the front of the paper, So not to deflect, but no, that's certainly not something that I know the specifics of.
It just sounds like the latter, because if it were the former, you might get a small shortfall because some of your bonds have downgraded or defaulted or whatever, but not all of them would happen in the same year. So because you've got that quite binary outcome, I suspect what you're seeing is a path dependency problem. And I'm not saying the annuities wouldn't outperform the bonds, but perhaps that hurdle or that margin that you're seeing will be much reduced. Be interesting, but happy to send him an email.
Excellent, thank you. Good commentary. Have we got any more questions? Just before we get to a fellow, have we got any more questions from students? Students, okay, one over here.
Hi, Mark Wolf. I'm a student. I was wondering whether your research actually tackled like the beginning of the journey of retirement planning. So in terms of, obviously, we're still talking of imminent retirees to have defined benefit plans, but in about a couple of decades later, we're now looking at a cohort which has no DB, you know, plans whatsoever. So I was wondering whether you've actually considered researching as well regarding getting to that point, what type of contribution levels are we talking about? Because some people may not have the property or equity release option. Some people may not have a big private pension or a savings pot to actually look into. So I was wondering whether that part of the research in terms of retirement planning actually have been covered yet, or if you're looking at also doing like a deconstruction by going at the very beginning and say, if you're age 21 and you wanted the £100,000 pot, what type of modelling you need to look into and to getting to that point?
So we have actually done some work on that. So actually about this time last year, I presented some of the research that we did, which is still available if you search for it. So it was looking at how the retirement challenges would be different for future generations of retirees. So we looked at 30 people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s from a variety of different sort of social economic backgrounds, so from very wealthy to people that were earning minimum wage, and projected their savings, their pension fund, their spending habits from that point until the point where they would likely retire, to look at how contribution levels, things like auto enrollment, things like that, could change the outcome at the point of retirement as to how much money they would actually have in order to then look at into solutions like that. So yeah, I'd say that is definitely something that we have considered before. And what was interesting about that research was just how different it was for not only people within the same age band having sort of different accesses to wealth, but also how there were some intergenerational differences. So the people in their 60s were far more likely to have property, even if they were in the lower sort of social economic cohort, than the people in their 30s were much less likely to have owned property by the point they're in retirement, which is a point that you made, that not everyone is likely to be able to benefit from equity release in the future. So yeah, I definitely think that it's important to consider that not all generations of retirees are really going to be facing the same issues, and that is something that we have done some work on already.
We had a question just behind you, John.
Martin White. Very interesting discussions. I particularly like contribution from over there. Oh, that's the best. My issue is perhaps a technical rather than the fundamental one with the paper. And it's that the base assumption set that's quoted for real returns on bonds and equities, etc., 2%, 2.3% real on bonds and 5% real on equities before expenses, I know it's got from looking back, but I really think it's amazingly unrealistic going forward. I'd knock at least 2%. Now, for example, taking the point of what if you put bonds in now, you'd get a negative real return. You'd be locking it in. And in a sense, when you buy an annuity, you're locking in whatever returns available on bonds. I think some of the outcome is a bit more rose-tinted than perhaps I think is reasonable. However, I think the point which your paper is essentially making is that annuities have a special property, namely they're still there when you get old, which is why the relative risk reward looks better if you put an annuity in. And so my question, or perhaps suggestion, is that even if you were to use what I regard as more realistic assumptions, would you get the same kind of relative attractiveness of putting annuities in the mix? My guess is yes, but that was my challenge. Is it dependent on the absolute returns coming out from the equities to give the outcomes that you're showing, or is it rather independent of that?
So I appreciate, obviously, we discussed earlier that you have different views on what would be a realistic assumption for those asset returns. I think one of the advantages of modelling it stochastically is that you can see how the results would be different under like a much wider range of investment conditions. It's obviously impossible to predict with absolute certainty what investments will be like in every single year of the future. And so I think that's why, where possible, we like to look at not just averages, but as Kyle showed, for the death benefit, like the range of results that you can get. So you are able to see that maybe if you think the average result is a little rose-tinted, how it could fall if you kind of look at maybe slightly worse returns than average. We didn't run the results assuming a different kind of baseline average. So at this moment in time, I'm not able to answer your questions to how the results would differ if we did change those assumptions. But I think from some of the results that we looked at as to how it varies on different investment scenarios, even in poorer cases and sort of in the lower sort of percentiles, you still see that the annuity seems to do pretty well against the bond equity strategy. So I wouldn't, while I can't 100% say for sure what the results would be, it wouldn't surprise me if we tweaked them a bit that we'd see sort of at least similar, a pattern of results, if not exactly the sort of absolute numbers.
Yeah, I would agree with Marilise's comments on that one. I think if we were to reassess the mean of our equity returns, we would see a change in the absolute level of the results, the absolute ability to meet income or death benefit. But ultimately, in the playoff between two components of a fund, whether it's bond or annuities, that would be unchanged as far as I could think. Again, from spending more time with the results, it doesn't seem that in poorer economic outcomes, bonds change its relative performance to an annuity.
I think we have time for a couple more questions. Anyone else in the audience? Over there, John.
James Thorpe, fellow. I just wondered whether or not you'd played around with the split between equity and annuity, or equity and bond, and if that changed the results.
Yes, we did. In the appendix of the paper, we have a couple of graphs that shows that if we kind of dial up the equity component or dial it down. Ultimately, the more equity that gets put in, the less of a difference there is, because ultimately you're kind of making the strategies more and more similar. The obvious extreme, if it's 100% equities, there's going to be no difference between the two strategies. And in general, if you increase the cash component, then every strategy does worse, because obviously over a long term, investing in cash is not really the answer unless you have a very low withdrawal rate. So yes, there are some examples of our results in the appendix of the white paper that demonstrate that. And as I said, all of the results are available on the JAST website to play around with.
Thanks.
Excellent. And who wants to have the last question of the evening? We've got over there Samir.
My name is David Keeler. I'm a fellow. It's not so much a question, it's more just an observation that I'm sure the mathematics absolutely work, but for people around retirement age at the moment, our memories go back to years when inflation was in double digits, and whatever the mathematics come out with the fact that you're trying to buy into an annuity at the interest rates as they currently are is something that's very difficult as a consumer for me to comprehend. So I think the strategy is absolutely spot on, but I think the market or the interest rates have got to get a bit higher before people will buy into these annuities. I think there's a lot of attraction in that, but there's so many working years of interest rates much, much higher. And it's still amazing to me, and probably many of my contemporaries, that actually interest rates from 2008 have stayed at the level they have. And there seems to be no sign of them increasing, but every year everybody sort of writes these reports that say interest rates must go up. But they haven't as yet, and they may not after Brexit, etc., and who knows. But it's still extremely difficult as a consumer to buy into these. If you could get a deferred annuity, fine, but not at the current interest rates either.
Thank you. We've had some really challenging questions tonight and some good observations also from the audience, so thank you for that. I really like the contenders for some of the prizes included the two-part question on behavioral economics and customer profile, so thank you for that. Mike, Tyler, thanks for your question or your observation. That was really good as well. The prizes tonight goes to the observation or question on bond equity modelling from the gentleman over here. So please do come collect your prize afterwards. And then for the student, it goes to the guy in the front row here. So well done, guys. Please do look at your emails, and if you have time, complete the online surveys or just send us any feedback you have on the talks or any improvements you think we can make, or just a well done if you like. And then there's networking drinks, so please do come join us for those as well. And then if we can just thank the speakers in the usual way.